Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Today's show is going to be wonderful, fabulous. First up, we're going to have international bestselling author Karen Slaughter on to talk about her book, Criminal. Next, we're going to have Jeffrey Wilson on, and he's going to talk about the donors, along with, last but not least, Allison Leota is going to be coming back on the show, and she's going to be talking about her book, Discretion, and she's going to have a little surprise for us, too, that we are working out, so hopefully this works out well. So here we go. Suspense Radio, 2 hours, starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Everybody, we want to welcome you here to another great episode we have of Suspense Radio, and we're going to start right off here with our first guest. Like I said, international bestselling author Karen Slaughter is back with her latest book in the Will Trent series called Criminal. Karen, thank you so much for taking some time out. How are you doing today?
I'm great, thanks.
So here we go. Criminal, the next book in the Will Trent series. Everybody can go to KarenSlaughter.com to find out all the information. It's great. You got I always find it interesting how there's always different book covers for whatever country it's going into, and you'll see the covers, which is just really cool also. So, Will Trent, how's he been since the last book had come out? We had Snatched, we had Fallen, now we got Criminal. How's he been doing?
Well, I mean, he's always great until I start writing a story and then something awful happens. He's getting along well in his life, I think. Criminal throws him for a loop, but it in many ways brings him closer together with Sarah and explains a bit about his life. So I think that's a good thing for him.
Yeah, I saw that you had written that there was an interview about where you were actually kind of interviewing. He was asking you questions about himself. And I thought that that was quite fascinating because the one question was, geez, why did you make me dyslexic? And I thought that was a really cool question. How is that to be able to now kind of interact with this character that's just such a big part of your life now?
Well, I mean, it was an interesting exercise. And the thing is, I do think of my characters as real people. And when I give them obstacles, I want to make sure that I understand them and that there are ways to talk about them as characters rather than just gimmicks. And so, you know, when you give a character something like dyslexia, you can't have him cured by the next book. So I was really careful to make sure I explained it to the reader. You know, Will can read. He just can't read quickly. And that, you know, this is a language processing disorder, and he's developed what I think are some really fascinating coping mechanisms to help him hide this from people. Fortunately, he's ashamed of it, but I think in many ways it gives him an understanding of criminals, because at the end of the day, criminals are hiding something, and so Will Trent, as someone who's also hiding something, can relate to them.
And when you're sitting there and you're thinking, because, you know, you had the Grant County series, and now you're in the Will Trent series with Criminal, when you're deciding, you know, to creating a character and just the complexity about him, because, you know, you're making him dyslexic and all these other kinds of things, and you know, to bring him to life, how monumental of it is it a process to create a character like that along with creating a book? I guess which is harder to do almost? Is it the actual plot of the story you're putting them into, or is it the whole surrounding that you have to do when you're creating the character to give them the believability?
Well, I think one always leads into the other. You know, I don't really write my character development separate from the plot. The plot always brings out new information about who this person is and what they're doing in their lives. And so with a book like Criminal, especially, where we go back in the past in the 1970s and we learn about Amanda Wagner, who's Will's boss, and sort of the silent influence that she's had on him for most of his life, it gives us insight into who he really is as a man. I mean, like a lot of men who are my age, he was raised by women. He's used to listening to women, and you know, he's a guy who occasionally can go off on his own path, but for the most part, he's just a really good guy, and he wants to do well in life, and he had a lot of things early on that would have directed him down a really dark path, and because he had help along the way, he was able to pull away from that. And in many ways, he's a self-created person, and I really like writing about him because of that, because I think it makes him interesting that he didn't take the easy path and do what a lot of people do. You know, a lot of young men who are raised in this foster care system or state care end up being in state care all their lives. They go to prison, they commit crimes, they just really struggle. And so to write about a success story, I think, in many ways, was much more interesting than writing about what is more than likely the norm.
And I totally agree, and I think that that's the fascinating part of the complexity of how fabulous of a writer that you are, because you do take into account, it's just the little things, it's the little details. Just from listening to you talk right now, you can understand that you're talking about just those little details that readers will pick up on, and that's what makes the whole story and the whole characters of just more complete.
Well, thank you. I mean, I absolutely try to do that. And, you know, I never want to just create a character and leave them hanging out there. I want there to be a reason for this character to exist. And I was very conscious when I was working on my Grant County books that eventually the whole of Grant County would be changed, you know, and I would be writing stories in Atlanta and Sarah would meet Will. And I wanted to make sure that Will was the type of guy you could really buy Sarah being interested in.
And speaking of Criminal, and you talk, just like you talked back, you went back to 1975, and the first thing when I just read the synopsis, the kind of first thing that came into my head was the Atlanta child murders, because I kind of grew up in the time, I think I was 8 or 9 years old, when they were first going on, and it was a serious problem. I mean, it was one of the biggest things that was going on in Atlanta around the time, and I didn't know if it was 75 or a little later, and I found out it was actually 1979. But was that, did you kind of take maybe like that premise, because it's 1975 and then you're bringing almost 40 years later back where those things are kind of coming back up to the future. Can you just explain a little bit about, you know, that past and the thing, and did that have anything to come into it?
Well, eventually I'd like to write a story about the Atlanta child murders, fictional, of course, because, you know, telling the truth would be extremely boring.
Yeah.
But when I was writing about Amanda and Evelyn, who are police officers in 1975, they work in the plainclothes division, I was very conscious that that was something on the horizon. And one of the interesting things I know, as someone who was living near Atlanta during that time, and of course was a child and saw all these horrible stories on the news, my step-aunt was the chief of detectives in a town close to Atlanta. And a couple of the cases ended up on her patch. And in the beginning of these murders, they were assigned to women mostly to investigate because they were part of the vagina crimes is what they called them. So anything that went into or came out of a vagina, that was what women investigated. You know, they didn't get the serious crimes. They didn't have a purview over, like, the murder squad. But, you know, if it was a missing child or something like that, they were called in. And so the earlier cases were handled mostly by female cops. And when it started to look like this was a bigger problem, of course, the men came in and took over. But it really was the women who started those earlier cases.
Yeah, and see, and that's a fascinating thing, because I grew up in Ohio, and, of course, there was no Internet back at that time. And you had to hear everything, whether it was, you know, nightly news or the newspaper the next day. And now when you're trying to go back and you're going back in time to 1975 and you're looking and you have to kind of change how all the police procedure was going on back then, and then you have to jump it forward 40 years in time, and then all that police procedural changes, how was that kind of dynamic to have to write? Because that's two totally different dynamics just in a single book.
Oh, absolutely. And I read so many forensic books from the 1970s, and they were so slim compared to the textbooks we have now. You know, they were just on the cusp of analyzing enzymatic properties of blood, and DNA was really kind of science fiction for a lot of people, especially someone working in Atlanta. And so, you know, it was in many ways easier to write about the crime because there wasn't some great scientific measurement that was going to point out who these people were. You know, in the earlier crime, they take scraping out from under a fingernail. Well, now we know that would immediately be taken to the DNA lab. It would be put into the system. It's very likely that, you know, a bad guy's name would pop up. But that's simply not the case in the 1970s. So it was kind of freeing in a lot of ways. I couldn't have someone just call on their cell phone or read an email or that sort of thing, or, you know, have this great science thing come out. I had to really rely on the ingenuity and the perseverance of the detectives and talking to people in person and then putting all the information together. One of the great things that modern policing has is all of these data analyzers who look at crimes and how they occur and look for patterns. And, you know, of course, if there's a witness and they can't find the witness, then, you know, there are all kinds of ways to search for background information. And, you know, I just was talking to someone who's an agent with the GBI, and they analyzed this one person they were looking for, and they couldn't find him, but they found a neighbor of his from 10 years ago, and the neighbor was on Facebook, and from Facebook they were able to find this guy who was hiding from the police. So, you know, that's a really extraordinary thing, but it just simply was not even heard of in the 70s.
Yeah, that's the one fascinating part whenever you're reading and that you pick up like an old Agatha Christie or one of those kinds of books, you see just the different development and how police procedural has worked over the time, and you had to put it here in a simple book to go, you know, 40 years difference, which, you know, in fact, 1975 was almost just like 1919, the way that they were almost doing their criminal because the technology hadn't caught up to yet. And was there a moment, and kind of even when you're writing, no matter if it's criminal, and again, we're speaking with Karen Slaughter here, and her website, KarenSlaughter.com, and the book is Criminal, the latest in the Will Trent series. When you're writing a book, whether it's criminal or whether it's Snatched or whether it's Fallen, anyone, do you ever have that moment where you're just kind of like, aha, and the light bulb goes off, you're like, that's it, there it is, that's what I meant to do, and you just race over the computer, you just start typing it, and you're just like, I got it.
Absolutely, but, you know, that's one of the joys of being a writer. Unfortunately, that's maybe two or three or four times during a book, and these books take a long time to write. You know, my friend Sarah Waters, who wrote a book I just absolutely adore called Fingersmith, among many other things, but Fingersmith was tremendous. She said, you know, it's like 10 minutes of sheer exhilaration where you think of those, well, they're going to do this and this and this, and then the rest is just work. Figuring out those moments that build into those aha times and, you know, just finding how that puzzle is going to fit together. And I'm working on my next book now, which is called Unseen, and I'm going through that trying to build up to this revelation that comes midway through the book and make sure that the emotion and excitement are there so that when this revelation does occur, it's that much more rewarding.
And I think that you can almost... that there's a time in the book that a reader can probably almost understand. You can, when you're going through, you can almost see the moment. You can almost see where it's shifted and it's changed, whether it's the emotion or the meaning of a character or a big time, you know, fight or whatever. You're almost writing that aha moment in there for fans to actually pick up on. Do you get emails like that? Do you get when people say, this is kind of where the book turned, and this is where it was for me, and this is like my favorite moment of you know, what you wrote?
Oh, yeah, and I love getting those emails because it tells me that not only are people paying close attention, which is always nice, but it tells me that I've done my job the right way because – you know, writers really want to make sure those emotional peaks and valleys are hit at the right time in a book, and so getting that feedback is really important.
Now, another thing you kind of do, a little off topic, and because I want to make sure that we talked about this, was you are really big, and you actually started with libraries, and it's called Save the Libraries, and it's something that you had started to Save the Libraries project. How is that going on, and how can people get involved, and what can they do to get involved, whether it's, you know, helping by giving money or just help with the libraries? How can they get involved with this project?
Well, I'm a real believer in supporting local libraries. So if you want to get involved, go down the street and support your local library, become a friend of the library, write them a check, volunteer, see what you can do to help them, because libraries really are in need right now. And the whole point of Save the Libraries is try to do as much as we can to support them. You know, I don't know any authors who didn't get their start in the library, and we all owe a debt of gratitude to them. So, you know, in the past, I've done Save the Libraries has either given block grants to different organizations, not just in America, but in Holland and in England. And we've done a couple of fundraisers so far. One is was in Atlanta. The other was in Boston, and we had people like Lee Child and Charlene Harris and Catherine Stockett and Tess Gerritsen, who basically said, yes, we want to support the library. They paid their own way for their own flight, or they drove themselves to Boston in many cases, and they paid for their own hotel rooms. And this way, all the money that was raised went directly to the library. That's what we want to do, is make sure that the library gets as much money as possible. And, you know, we're working on another, hopefully soon, maybe February of next year, another fundraiser in Seattle to try to do the same thing, where we can generate some money and some attention, because a lot of people aren't aware that libraries are in such desperate need, so that we can generate more funding and reach more people and help more people.
And not only do I totally agree, but when we talked with you the last time on the radio show, I went out and I kind of revisited the library, actually. Even though we get like 3,000 books a year to review and we just simply can't get them all, the library is a way for me to kind of go back and catch up on those old Agatha Christie's or those Sherlock Holmes, those books that you just, you know, that the library has and you just can't find, and you're just kind of reinventing yourself. And I walked in and I was just amazed by how much bigger the library, like, technically moved on, has kind of become from when it was, you know, when we were a child and it was the Dewey Decimal System and everything else. And I think that that's just amazing how well that they've been able to come along, but they do need to have continual support, otherwise they will go away.
Well, and you're absolutely right, but the big thing is, with the economy such as it is, more people are using the library, and it's such a key component for many different things that service the community, whether it's, you know, English as a second language class or child reading groups. But one thing people don't tend to know is that if you want a job at Walmart, for instance, you have to apply online. If you don't have a computer at home or internet access, the library is the only place you can go where that's free. And so people can go to the library, they can fill out applications, they can check email. And this is really not something new for libraries to have access to technology that people could not afford for themselves. I mean, even back when Ray Bradbury was a young man, he rented a typewriter at his local library for 15 cents an hour, and that's what he wrote his first books on. So, I mean, there's a long, long history of libraries embracing technology and offering it to people to help them get a leg up in the world.
Yeah, I'm so true. Everything that you say is because how I'm kind of transitioning also is that it's the same kind of way in the publishing field. It's just the change over from how libraries were, how they are now, and very much technology savvy. And the publishing kind of world has kind of shifted also, just from when you started writing to the way it is now. How has that change been with you also as an author, as you've seen it kind of go? And it's been extremely fast, on how it's changed just in the last 2 years alone. Does it make it more difficult for you as a writer? Does it make it easier for you, seeing as how the publishing era has changed so much?
Well, not really. I think it's great that more people are reading. I'm not an author who thinks that digital devices are of the devil. You know, I love holding actual books, but I also, when I travel, use a Nook or a Kindle or my iPad to read books. I think it's great to have all those different platforms. And, you know, if anything, I think it's easier in many regards for some writers because, of course, self-publishing is a much more viable option than it used to be. But it's also, you know, a much more crowded field now because before, at least with self-publishing, you know, if you really believed in your work and you wanted to publish it, you had to put some money behind it. But, you know, I just think everything has its place. I don't think that real books are going to go away anytime soon. And I'm, you know, to bring this back to the libraries, a lot of people can't afford these devices,
right.
Or they don't have a credit card. So even if they could afford a device, they couldn't download any books. And that's where the libraries come in for these people. It's making sure that there's not such a huge separation between people who have access to reading and people who don't. A lot of people think reading is a luxury, but we know from study after study and even brain scans that kids who read from an early age develop pathways in their brains that non-reading children do not. And these pathways give them, you know, critical understanding and critical thinking that they need later in life. And if that's not developed in childhood, it just doesn't happen. And if a kid can get that on a Nook, that's great. If he can get it with a real book, that's great.
You know, and speaking of kids, what's the youngest child that you've ever received an email from that said that they've read your book?
Well, I remember there was a little kid named Jeremy who was 12 years old, and he wrote to me because he was doing a book report on one of my novels, and I thought he was a little young to be reading that, and I asked him if he had cleared it with his teacher, and he had, and so, you know, I let him interview me. I still think that's a little too young. But, you know, kids are different. They develop at different ages. And, I mean, adults are reading young adult fiction now, so it's not surprising that kids are reading adult fiction.
And do you get, like, different kind of questions? It's just different kinds of views just to see it from the mind of a 12-year-old on whether, you know, how they're interviewing you and the questions that they feel are important as far as, like, the book and things like that?
Well, there are usual questions, you know, like where did you get your idea for this,
okay,
or things like that. But the book he was talking about was one that had a really big twist at the end that sort of made your jaw drop, hopefully, if I did my job, and that's what he was concentrating on.
Yeah, that's got to be a little fun and just a little shocky just to know that, you know, you have a 12-year-old out there. 12-year-old is what, 7th grade, I think? Sixth, seventh grade, out there doing a book report on one of your books, and you kind of get that email. It's kind of, I don't know if that would be odd or not. I don't know. I mean, how that would make like me feel if that ever happened.
Well, I mean, it is odd. The ones that always give me pause are actually, they're very flattering, is when a professor is teaching it, you know, as part of a writing class or something like that. And that's always fun too, because it's nice to talk to people who want to be writers and, you know, to be immersed in that. And, of course, being in the thriller genre, which tends to not get much respect, it's always nice to be recognized by someone teaching literature.
Yeah, and I never quite figured out why thrillers kind of have that stigmata of, I guess, oh, it's not real writing, it's popular fiction or blah, blah, blah. I've never quite figured that one out yet.
Well, I think it's just an intellectual backlash, you know. But when a thriller or a piece of crime fiction becomes very popular with people who think they're smarter than everyone else, they always say it transcends the genre. So you can't really win for losing in this.
That's true. Now, real quick, I got two quick questions left. So what scares Karen Slaughter? Because your books, you know, are kind of shocking, like you just said, jaw-dropping. What scares Karen Slaughter, whether it's a book or just real life?
Well, you know, I read a lot of dark material. I read autopsies and things like that. And I think that when I do, I have a bit of a clinical remove. But if you want to know an author who just scares the bejesus out of me, it's Mo Hayter. I mean, she's a fantastic writer. She's really, really good at pulling you into a deeply psychological tale. And I can't, of course, name specific scenes because it would ruin the books for people, but that's the kind of book I read when I want to be scared.
And so what's sitting right now on your DVR?
On my DVR?
You're probably out, like you said, you're out on book tour, you're taping shows. What's on your DVR are you going to come back and watch?
Breaking Bad, of course. And I love Suits. I think that's a fun show. It's on USA. And Parks and Recreation is another one. I love Amy Poehler, and I think it's just a really hilarious ensemble piece.
So now, did any of your shows get canceled?
I was watching the Ashley Judd show, Missing. I'm really ashamed. It was so awful, but I'm a big Ashley Judd fan, and, you know, you got to support, even though I don't think she was born in the South, but, you know, she comes right. by it honestly.
Yeah, I was a little upset over Alcatraz, so...
what happened with that? It just was, and none of the people
I thought it was
who
doing
came
really
back,
well.
But none of the people who came back were like, "Wow, the internet," or you know, they were from the
'50s
and they didn't.
I have no idea. I don't know what happened. It was just like all of a sudden gone. I thought it was fabulous, and then all of a sudden they said, "No, we're canceling." It's like, why do you cancel the good ones and keep some of the crappy ones?
I know.
All right. Well, Karen. Awful. We want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, everybody, the book is Criminal, and the website is KarenSlaughter.com. Karen, again, thank you so much for coming on. Best of luck with Criminal, and we'll talk to you in the future.
Great, thanks. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, Karen Slaughter, the book is Criminal, the latest book in the Will Trent series. You can go to KarenSlaughter.com to find out all the information on Karen and everything else that she's doing. Fabulous website, very informative for her fans and readers. And, again, the book is Criminal. It's available wherever books are sold, however they're sold, you can go get it. We are going to come back here after this short break with our next guest, Jeffrey Wilson, and he's going to be talking about his latest book, The Donors. So in the meantime, yes, I actually have some new music for you, and here you go. everybody, welcome back here. We want to thank you very much again for joining us. We want to thank Karen Slaughter for being on the show right now with her book, Criminal. And we also want to just thank all of our readers and fans. We had another great issue that we just put out a couple weeks ago, our August issue. We're working on September right now. If you don't get your four free issues, we urge you to email editor@suspensemagazine.com to get that. And also, if you haven't started reading the Green Lake series, which is our original book put together by me and Donald Allen Kurtz, and it's an ongoing series that you're able to read on the blog and also through BarnesandNoble.com, Smashwords, and it's free. And we literally update it every couple weeks, and you're able to follow along. It's basically like a TV show that you're reading into a book form, and it's very entertaining. We're having a lot of fun doing it. So check out your free edition of Green Lake by your host, John Robb, and Donald Allen Kurtz for writing it together. So that's always fascinating. Well, we want to bring right now on our next guest, author Jeffrey Wilson. His book is called The Donors. His website is jeffreywilsonfiction.com to find out more information about him. So, Jeff, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you having me. Good to be here.
Hey, no problem. We want to thank you for coming on, and we also want to find out a little bit about Donors. So can you tell us a little bit about the book, a little behind the scenes of exactly what it is? Because when the first thing I noticed just from looking at it, before I even picked it up, I looked at the cover, and I saw the man, and I got scared of the man. So... Yeah. Okay. So maybe the man has something to do with the inside.
Yeah, that's right. It was a creepy cover, wasn't it? I remember the first time I saw it, my first reaction was, oh, my God, did I write something so horrific that it would inspire someone to draw that cover? It's terrible. But, yeah, so
it's the male version of my first girlfriend.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that, John. So The Donors is a supernatural thriller. It's set in a hospital, which... is, I think, always a terrifying setting because hospitals are so terrifying anyway, which was sort of what inspired me to write it. You know, you're so vulnerable in a hospital when you're a patient, and there's everything about being there is horrifying already. And so if you can set a thriller in that setting, I think it brings the horror up a notch for sure. But this book, the other thing that makes it a little more horrific is that the main character is a very young child. He's 5 years old, almost six. And he's in the hospital because he's been injured by his mother's boyfriend and has got some burns and a broken arm. And he's there recovering, and he's having these bad dreams. And in these dreams, he's seeing things happening within the hospital, what he calls these lizard men that are creeping about the hospital. And he at first thinks they're dreams, but comes to realize that there's more going on than that. And with a childlike innocence, he can see things that maybe adults would miss. So that's sort of the basic premise, is there's these evil creatures that are taking people from the hospital and using hospital staff to do terrible things to them, and this little boy is part of that and one of the few people that can see him for what they really are, that and his physician, an ER doctor, who has a similar childhood to this poor little boy, and they become very close, and together they have to stop these creatures before their own loved ones fall victim to them. So that's sort of the basic premise of the book.
Yeah, I mean, hospitals are a very creepy place, and I don't like them. I don't know a lot of people who do like them. So whenever you start writing about something, and you can always talk about, because there's always behind the scenes stuff that goes on about hospitals that people don't understand. And I think that kind of the same way that kind of Jaws took over the ocean, it's like a lot of these books and these things like what you're writing here, they kind of freak the hell out of people even more when they go into these situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that most normal people, when they're in a hospital, it's intimidating because the whole thing is unknown. Like, we all have fear of the unknown, right? They say that's the scariest thing is just the unknown, and once you understand things, it's not so scary. And when you're a patient in the hospital, the entire experience is one unknown after another. And so it's a very intimidating place to be. It's a frightening place to be. You don't know if you're well. You don't know if you're sick. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what people are going to do to you. And if you can add an additional element to that, it's really easy to come up with something that's a little bit terrifying. So
would you categorize it? And what I try to address when I did my letter from the editor here in the magazine was I was trying to kind of clarify to let people kind of know, to kind of understand exactly what kind of genre you're writing, so you kind of know exactly what kind of people that you're kind of going out to try to get, you know, as far as readers. Would you classify this maybe more as like a horror thriller, or is this more of a straight thriller? So people kind of like have an idea of what they're, you know, going to get involved in, because when you look, like I said, just from looking at the cover, and you know, people are going to automatically think horror. And
absolutely.
That's what, and that's,
you know,
what you want them to do, yeah.
This one, more than my first book, is got a lot more purity to the horror elements, I think, than my first novel, The Traitor's Ring. Both of them are sort of a little bit of cross-genre, which I know is a big buzzword that I almost hate using now because it's so overused. But they both blend other genres with the supernatural elements. But certainly this book is falls more into the horror thriller category than my first book did. That one had supernatural elements too, but this is, they're a driving force in this book. So yeah, it would absolutely be accurate to say that it's a horror thriller. With aspects of the medical blended in, for sure.
You know, and our magazine covers in the radio show, we cover suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. And I have to say that I think that horror, while it's probably the least popular in the four of that I just mentioned, is probably really the most fun to write as a writer, because you don't really have any structure when you're doing horror. You can do any damn thing that you want, but when you're doing a mystery, you kind of have the formula of whodunit. When you're doing a thriller, it has to be really fast-paced. You have to keep people going. When you're doing suspense, you have to kind of have the ups and the downs and the valleys to where you're kind of hanging them on the seat, and then you kind of let them go, and then you kind of bring them back. But horror is totally different. You can do any damn thing you want. Anything.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's very liberating as a writer, isn't it? Because you can blend in any elements. You're limited only by your own creativity and your own imagination as to what you can put in there and how you can make it play. But I think that it also puts some restrictions on you, because it's very easy to be trite when you write in horror. You know, if you're just one more vampire story or you're one more werewolf story, then you've done nothing remarkable. It's been a genre that's been written in for hundreds of years, and so it's hard to find something that's unique. It's hard to put a unique twist or spin on some of the horror elements that have been out there for a long time. But yeah, there's a huge advantage of being able to say, well, that's because this supernatural thing happened. I don't have to explain it to you. It is what it is. So yeah, it's liberating. It requires a lot of creativity, but it is a little bit liberating to be able to just sit down and make things up as you go, for sure. But and it's funny that you say that it's the least popular. You're absolutely right, and you almost get trained as a writer to sort of shy away from claiming that your book is horror, and people say, oh, it's horror, and they kind of look down your nose at it, like sort of like they do for a lot of thriller genres, but horror maybe more than most. And yet, if you really talk to people, they say, oh, yeah, I don't really like horror. Well, I like Stephen King. Well, yeah, I like Joe Hill stuff. Oh, yeah, I like Koontz. I like, you know, it's like, well, that's all horror. You know,
right.
if you can write something that is rich in character development and blend the horror elements in, I think that that's a really good formula for writing books that people enjoy, even if it's a guilty pleasure that they try not to admit to their friends.
Yeah, I think that the horror genre is definitely miscalculated, because people put gore with horror, and they're two totally separate things. When you see a gory movie on Hollywood and they call it a horror movie, that is so far removed from what an actual horror book is, which is getting you scared from the things that you don't see, like the old Halloween movies, like the Amityville Horrors, which scared the hell out of you because it was the stuff that you didn't see that you thought you heard, and things of anticipation coming, and the deep scaredness of when you went home, you were scared to go to sleep, like a Jaws, you were scared to go in the water. And that's what horror is. It's not blood and gore and, you know, shit flying all over the walls.
That's exactly right, and that's the debate. And the debate is, you know, at Horror Writers Association, once every few months on the discussion boards, it'll all come up. Well, what the hell is horror? And everybody wants to define it. And it's funny how every reader and every writer always has their own slightly different definition of what horror is, which is fine. You know, if something scares you, then there's a horror element to it. I think that when you look at the slasher movies and you look at just the straight up gore movies, Hostel and stuff like those. Those things, that's easy to do. You can make things bloody and gory. But it also is a little bit boring after a period of time. If you want to keep a reader captivated, you got to give them something more than just the horror. You have to give them something that's believable that they can latch onto. And so the real challenge is to make your characters and your story so believable that when you throw in this insanely supernatural element, the reader is so into the story and the characters have become so real to them that they can accept that, that they can say, okay, well, I guess that could happen because, look, it's happening to these people that are so real to me. That's the challenge, I think, of writing the supernatural type of horror stories, is you got to make it believable, and the only way you can do that is to build realistic characters, build realistic storylines outside of the supernatural elements. So it can certainly have its own challenges, but you know, it's what I grew up reading, it's what I love to read, it's what I enjoy writing, and it's a lot of fun, I think.
And we're speaking here with author Jeffrey Wilson, and his book is called The Donors, jeffreywilsonfiction.com. And the book is available wherever you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever. So when you're writing horror and you decide this is something that you're going to do, how long was this novel kind of in your head? Was it the characters that more got you involved? Was it the idea of the plot that you decided to write on first? What kind of was the beginning structure of The Donors?
In this book, it was more the idea. My first book, The Traitor's Ring, was all character-driven. It was all about the characters, and then the plot originated from these characters that became very real. But in the case of The Donors, I had this idea. You know, you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning from a bad dream or something, and you're like, oh, you know, it would make a really good story. And this was more like that kind of story, the idea of the story. What if you were in a hospital and this was going on? My God, that would be terrifying. And it sort of grew from there. The characters became really important very early on because in order to capture the audience with the idea, I wanted something that they could relate to. And I think everyone has a natural empathy for children, especially children that have had a trauma or have had a misfortune, and it just really tears at your heartstrings. And so the idea came to, hey, let's make the main character, instead of making it this ER doctor, let's make it this little kid, and he's sort of this, you know, unlikely hero. And so that made it fun. But it's definitely the story in this one. In fact, it started as a short story that I never published. It was just one of those things you write on a Saturday because you're, here's a good idea. And I wrote it in a couple of hours and stuck it in a desk drawer and kind of ruminated there for a couple of years. And after I had written my first book, I came back to this story. I was like, wow, this would make actually a pretty good book. And so I picked it up from there. But definitely story, plot-driven initially, rather than trying to build a story around the characters.
So you immerse yourself a lot because you mentioned the Horror Writers Association and you were at Thriller Fest now. How has those kind of experiences been? Because this was your third, you know, your first Thriller Fest, being able to meet a lot of the authors that you had, you know, read and keep reading. How has that experience kind of been, kind of taking the tour out with your book, The Donors, and kind of doing it since this is not your first book, but this is kind of maybe, is this like your first bigger tour and kind of how you're wrapping
yourself
up on all those conferences?
Yeah, this one is definitely, most definitely, this one's getting more attention than the first one did, and it's been a lot of fun. Horror writers and ITW, the International Thriller Writers, have been phenomenal experiences for me. And I think it's just because of the fellowship of other writers, you know what I mean? Writing is kind of a lonely business, and you sort of do it by yourself, hidden from your wife and your kids in a room somewhere for hours at a time. And just to be able to sit and have a glass of wine with some other writers and realize you're not as weird as you thought they were, they're kind of all the same. You know, we all have the same fears and we all have the same drive and ambition and imagination. So I think more than anything else, that was phenomenal for me, to just be able to hang out with other writers and talk about the craft. But then also there's the business end that you learn about from being around, you know, more experienced writers and tips that they can give you, not just craft tips, but business tips for how to do things. So it's been phenomenal. I really, really enjoyed the fellowship of writers I've been able to experience with both those organizations.
What's kind of like one of the biggest tips that you received from an author as far as business that you now incorporate into your business?
You know, the big thing that people like to always talk about is, you know, marketing, how to market your work. And I think that now more than ever, that's become important for writers. You know, the days where there's just a couple of giant houses and if they buy your work, you can just, you know, sit at home and they'll give you your interview schedule. I think those days are gone. If you're not doing some self-promotion, no matter how big or small you are, or at what point you are in your career, then you're not fully capitalizing on the potential of any of your books. And so it's fun to hear the different opinions of what people are doing, what the successful people have done in the past or what they recommend. What's also interesting is that it's different for all of them. And almost all the writers tend to find their own style of promotion and marketing. So it's fun to sort of cherry pick from the ideas of these successful people and say, oh, that would work for me. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't be comfortable doing that, that kind of thing. So, yeah, in terms of the business end, I think that's been what I've gained the most from, you know, how to put up a website and what to do with it and how to interact with readers and get exposure, those sorts of things. So it's been great for that.
Yeah, and what you say is just so much, just so true to the fact of, because you're on our radio show now, and this is an outlet for you to be able to find, you know, we have over 48,000 listeners that we, that, you know, listens that we get on our show. And it's one of these things, we just had Karen Slaughter on too, and, you know, she's a national best-selling author, but she now has to keep doing all those things. There's no more just straight book tours. And I think that a lot of the authors, and I can't tell them enough, and I keep saying and I keep saying, as soon as you write the end in your book, all you're pretty much done is starting at the starting gate. Now you have to. Now it's the beginning. Now is the hard work, where you might even agree, writing the book is easy. Selling the damn thing and marketing, now that is the difficult part.
I couldn't agree with that more. And some of the other mechanical aspects of it, too, that you don't appreciate till you've written your first book, or published your first book, I should say, because, you know, when I was writing books and trying to sell them, you write a book and you send out query letters, and then you've got all kinds of time to focus on the next project. Once a book is purchased and you've got edits and deadlines and all this other stuff, it's like, man, I used to be able to write a book in about 8 or 10 months. Now it takes me well over a year because I've always got something else I've got to do. The publisher wants a change of this or a change of that. You've got a third book coming out in 2013. Have you started the edits yet? It's like, oh, my God, we just started promoting this one. And so that stuff you don't think about when you sit down and say, I think I want to write some books. You don't think about all these other things and how they're going to impact your ability to stay creative and stay fresh, because you never can just let go of a project. You're always promoting and going on interviews, and you're going to book signings, or you're at your website answering mail or whatever. So it's a lot busier than I expected it to be. That aspect of it is a lot more time consuming than I appreciated, I think.
And we're speaking here again with author Jeffrey Wilson, and his book is called The Donors. JeffreyWilsonFiction.com is his website. So coming back to the book, is there one character, one moment in the book that surprised you when you kind of ripped back and reread it and finished the edit, took the stuff, put them on the cutting room floor, that you feel is the essence of what you were trying to get through with the book?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question, especially for this book, because one of the challenges of writing this book was writing from the point of view of a child. It's something I tried again in my fourth book that I just finished, but an older child. That child is like 11 or 12. Here I'm writing from the point of view of a 5 or 6-year-old. And throughout the entire thing, there's this huge fear that you just haven't pulled it off. I mean, I've read books where they've tried to do that and done it well. I've read them where they've done it badly. And it can just destroy a really good story if you can't have a real ring of truth to writing that POV. And what was nice was with the edits, especially with the help from the publisher and getting through all the edits and making things tighter, when I went back and read the final version, I was delighted to see that this little boy was really real to me, how he got crafted through the edits and such. So that was the greatest accomplishment, I think, was being able to write a 5-year-old hero and make him real and make him identifiable to adults, young adults, and have them, you know, believe in him and believe that this character is doing these kinds of things. So I would say that was the biggest pleasant surprise of the entire book. And I, like, totally relate to this character now. I just love this little boy. He's very real to me. I'm a dad, so that helped me. I didn't have to just pull it out of thin air. I've got a son who's 5 now, and I've got a son, as you know, Connor Wilson, another writer, who's just turned 12. So I've been through the 5-year-old stage, and I kind of know how their little brains work, and that I don't think I could have done it without that. But I was still really worried about whether I'd pull that off, and I was glad when I did.
You know, and you just mentioned something, and I say we give some props to Connor, your 12-year-old, who, first of all, his birthday is today, so we will say happy birthday. And he has some very exciting news, and you have got to be gushing as a father to be able to kind of let the news. So I'll let you explain exactly, again, Connor, 12 years old, and what has he been able to accomplish now?
Yeah, so my 12-year-old son, I'm really proud of the books that I've written, but the biggest pride for me in writing right now is I get to say I'm the father of the youngest traditionally published fiction writer in America. Connor's book, A Giant Pencil, was just released last Saturday at a big book launch at the Glaser Children's Museum in Tampa, and the book has been doing great. He wrote that book, started writing it just before his 9th birthday, finished it in a few months, handwritten in pencil and in a spiral notebook because he wanted to write books like Daddy did, and he came up with this story that's just brilliant. It's just a great story. It's a children's book, and you can learn more about it at his website, which is thegiantpencil.com, www.thegiantpencil.com. But, man, we are so proud of him. He's just handled it all with grace and hasn't changed him. He's just the same little kid. All he wants to do is skateboard and play laser tag, but he's got this tremendous accomplishment of writing a book at such a young age. So, yeah.
You're going to let him write horror?
Busy summer for us.
Yeah, are you gonna let him write horror?
You know, it's funny. Somebody asked him in an interview, you know, who writes better, you or your dad? He goes, children's books definitely me, but horror, that's not my thing. He scares himself to death. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. At least not
that's
yet.
Good.
Although he's working on his second book now, and he's trying to put a ghost character in there. So there's
already creeping in. It's the ghosts are already creeping in.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's just, first of all, fabulous. Not only the 12-year-old is writing, but a 12-year-old is reading. And I think that that's a losing battle today with all the social media networks and everything that they have and the distractions to go on. Whereas, you know, when it was you and me growing up, we didn't have any of these technological things, and we had to sit down, and if your friends were busy, you either sat down and read a book, wrote something, or you really just kind of sat there and looked at the walls.
Oh, my gosh, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, the video games and the DS and even
their
phones. Yeah, so you didn't have any of that, and we're really excited that all of our kids love to read, and that's something we've tried to instill in our kids from an early age, reading books to them and stuff. But Connor was able to keep that. He has been an avid reader. He'll tell you that he just doesn't like to read when he has to read. So it could be the greatest book in the world, but if his school assigns it to him, then it's a piece of crap. He doesn't want to read it. But that's just being a middle schooler, I guess. But, yeah, he loves to read, and that's why he's able to write, you know, and he goes to a school that has instilled that in him. So parents out there, keep your kids reading. Maybe they'll write a book. You don't know.
Right. So the journey's been interesting, I guess, for you. You've definitely now, you've kind of hit your stride, and like you said, this is kind of like your longer launch that you've been able to do, and you're already writing the third book. So is this kind of the genre that we're going to have you in? Is this where you're going to be? Is this where you are comfortable now with the book, like the donors and the horror category? Is that what you want?
Yeah, you know, my books always have a little blend, this one less than the others for sure. But, yeah, it's hard for me to write outside of at least the loose confines of that genre. I've tried that before. I've tried to write a straight-up thriller, and there's that little voice in my head that says, dude, what if his partner was a ghost? Or, hey, guy, what if that guy was already dead and he doesn't even know it? You know, there's always that little voice whispering in my ear from all of those books I read when I was a kid, I guess. So it's definitely where I'm most comfortable. My third book, which is already finished, called Fade to Black, is a little less straight-up horror, but it definitely has a lot of horror elements. It's got a lot of supernatural twists in it. And the fourth book that I also just finished writing that I'm shopping now, same thing, has some ghost elements in it and that sort of thing. The book I'm actually just working on now is the first one that doesn't really have a huge supernatural component. So we'll see how that goes. But I already have my idea for the next one, and it's right back in the mix. So.
Wow. Yeah, you just got to get right back up in the saddle. There you go.
That,
I mean,
that's right.
It's a 24-7 job. That's what
that's
it is.
Right.
I mean, it's 24/7.
And if you find something that works, why would you change it, right?
Exactly. Well, I'm going to tell you what, Jeffrey. We want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, everybody, JeffreyWilsonFiction.com. The book is The Donors. So, Jeff, thank you again so much for coming on. Enjoy your day. And, you know, we look forward to seeing what's coming out from you in the future.
Great. Thanks again for having me. You guys have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So again, everybody, Jeffrey Wilson is the author. The book is called The Donors. To find out a lot more information, you can go to jeffreywilsonfiction.com, pick up the book wherever books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, and go get them. We are going to take another short break, and we're going to be back with our last guest of the show, Allison Leota, and her book is called Discretion. It is the second in her series that she has written. The last one was Law of Attraction, and she's going to do something a little bit different. We talked about this off of the air to kind of do something a little different with you guys to see if it works, and we want you to, you know, kind of email us back and let us know. You can email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com to see if this works and you know, how well it kind of portrays itself as far as, you know, the book. So in the meantime, I got some oldies, but they're goodies for you. So enjoy and listen to this.
Why do I find it hard to write the next line?
and I want to thank our first guest that we're on here first today was author Karen Slaughter and her book CriminalKarenSlaughter.com, and we just had Jeffrey Wilson on with his book called The Donors, and it's JeffreyWilsonFiction.com. But now we want to bring on a good friend of ours, and she just wrote her latest book called Discretion, which is the latest in her Anna Curtis series. The first book was Law of Attraction, which re-rated as one of the best books of 2010. Allison Leota. So, Allison, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Hi, John. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So we saw you at RWA. You kind of flew all the way back. You hadn't been home in so long. Have you had a chance to catch your breath yet?
No, I haven't really. I actually am working on my third book now, which is due at the end of August. So it's been a crazy summer, but fun.
Yeah, so just to tell people, so you really want to be a writer. Well, I'll tell you what, it's not as glamorous as you might think.
That's right, that's right. Mostly I sit around in my yoga pants and try to get something on my computer and then usually end up going back and taking that all out and starting over again. So not glamorous at all.
So again, so we had talked with you before when you had your debut book out, Law of Attraction, and you had your character that you were writing on, which is an assistant U.S. attorney, and which is really close, you know, that's what you had done before you've now decided to write full-time. You very much into the sexual victims, I guess you want to say almost the sexual victim, sexual crimes prosecutor, which is what you were doing. And so you wrote about kind of what you knew, and Anna Curtis was kind of born, and now we have Discretion. So how's the journey been? I mean, is it kind of true that the second book is more difficult to write than the first one because you have more time restraints on it?
Well, that's right. I was a prosecutor in D.C. for 12 years. I specialized in prosecuting sex crimes and domestic violence. And so in my first book, you may not be shocked to find out that the protagonist was a young AUSA, a federal prosecutor specializing in sex crimes and domestic violence. And it really was helpful to be able to take what I was doing on a day-to-day basis and take these incredible stories, these moments of, you know, incredible courage, also moments of horror and some of the worst things folks could do with each other, and process that in the pages and have some control over what was happening on the pages. For book number two, it was an interesting transition because I thought I was writing one book, and Touchstone, the imprint at Simon & Schuster I was working for, I thought I had started a series. So, it's an interesting transition. I kept that same world, the same characters, but now, you know, what do you do with your characters after they've had their happily ever after? And I think that's actually a great question for everybody. We all have our moments of happily ever after, and then what do you do the next morning when you wake up? So it was an interesting thing for me to explore in this fictional character.
And so was it something that was, because like you said, you didn't realize that you were going to end up writing a series, so now you kind of have to go back, and did you catch yourself having to go back in the first book to say, okay, I have to make sure I had a favorite color right, or I had to make sure I got these things right, because the readers are going to find out, and they're going to let you know whether you screwed it up or not.
That is so true, John. That's so true. That part wasn't so difficult for me because I feel like I know this character, these characters so well, backwards and forwards. But, it was coming up with a new set of, a new case and a new set of facts for her. So in the first book, I was dealing with a domestic violence homicide. And in the second book, I thought, you know, that was such dark subject matter. And, you know, you have to live in this world that you're creating. Whatever world you're creating as a novelist, you're living in for that year, however long it takes you to write it. And I thought this time, maybe I'll do something lighter, something that's just going to be a little easier to write. So I thought I'd focus on the world of high-priced escorts and their sex trade in D.C. Which, right, you laugh, and I probably should have talked
to you before.
No, because
as a male, as a male, that's a pull-in right there, I'm telling you.
Well, it turned out to be just as dark as the first one, and maybe that's just what I write. Maybe I just write dark, romantic suspense.
Right.
Maybe that's all right. But it actually, there were some really interesting, I think some really fascinating parts of this business and some very dark parts, too. I went to this trial. A lot of what I was kind of inspired by was this real trial in D.C., about a woman that the press called the D.C. Madam. And, you know, it was a typical kind of high-end escort agency. She catered to a lot of politicians and powerful guys. And one of the witnesses that I was just fascinated by was this fella whose job was to be her tester. So the madam lived in California, but she was running this escort agency in D.C. So
okay.
She would send any prospective escorts, job applicants, to a man who would try them out in bed, you know, for their bedroom skills. And if he liked them, then the madam would hire them. And if he didn't, then that was the end of it. And that was his job for her. And he got the girls for free or greatly discounted because of it. And he did this for many, many years and then was caught and he had to testify. And he was this lawyer at a very kind of high-profile, very powerful firm in D.C. who just kind of did this as a side thing. And I was fascinated by the idea of this double life, that this is the sort of guy that I might have a case against. And he had, you know, this double life that he was leading.
And now, did you do a lot of maybe on-the-ground research? Were you kind of in it? Did you already, was this something that you had come across while you were working as a prosecutor, like a similar case or something to that effect, where that was kind of like their light bulb to say, hey, this is something that I want to write about?
Absolutely. As a sex crimes prosecutor, a lot of the victims were women who, and men sometimes also, who worked in the sex trade. They are very, very vulnerable victims, and predators know that. Predators know that a lot of them are throwaways. You know, the parents have told them to get out of the house, or runaways. Nobody is looking for them. If they go missing, you know, it's going to be a long time till somebody says, where did they go? And they're very often in extremely vulnerable situations, alone with a strange guy, often in a hotel room where nobody's going to hear what's going on. So I had a lot of cases that involved women and men who were working in the sex trade when they were assaulted. So I had a lot of that to draw on when I started writing Discretion.
And now what's more difficult? Prepping for a case that you know is going to be hard, whether it's circumstantial evidence or writing a book?
Well, that's interesting. Go ahead, John.
No. So, I mean, it's just, I know that they're kind of different emotional-wise, but which one, I guess, is just a little bit more, I don't know whether it's anxious to finish or, you know, it's just, which is just a little bit more above the top.
So, they say there are only three kinds of stories in the world, right? There's man against man against nature, and man against self, or, woman against woman against nature, woman against herself. And as a prosecutor, it's very much man against man. It's an adversarial system. It's set up that way. It's the prosecutor versus the defense attorney, and there's this idea that truth will come out if, you know, everybody does their job right. But so you're as a prosecutor, your job is to bring out the truth. But as a novelist, it's very much man against himself or woman against herself. Like you, it's just you, and you have
right.
to do the best that you can in telling this story. And you're also trying to go for truth. You're trying to get this story that has the ring of truth, that feeling that it's authentic and it could really happen and this is how it would really go down. But you're just making it up as opposed
right.
to, you know, as a prosecutor where you're very much stuck with and you hew to whatever is the truth. So it's these very different exercises. And, as a prosecutor, there are these very real lives that you're dealing with. So it has this gravitas, this importance. But as a novelist, I also know there's this big team that's depending on me, and I really want to come through for them. So both have their challenges and their rewards, I guess.
So I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Allison Liotta, and the book is called Discretion. AllisonLiotta.com is the website. And now this comes the point, because I've been kind of letting everybody know that this is, we're going to do something a little different. And at RWA, and then we started talking to say, let's try to do something a little different for the radio show that no one's ever heard. So you, I'm going to stall a little bit so you can get ready, is you're actually going to go ahead right now live on the air and you're going to read an excerpt from the book and then we're going to kind of discuss it afterwards and it's going to be a little bit something different. So people will now have the idea, and I think you said you're going to read the beginning. So they're going to know right off the beginning what's going to happen, what's coming up, to get an idea of your writing and everything that's going to be wrapped around. So I just want to say, whenever you are ready, Allison, go for it.
Okay, here we go. Chapter 1. Even now, Caroline got nervous before every big job, and this was bigger than most. She knew how to smile past smirking hotel concierges and apartment building doormen who deliberately looked the other way. The key was looking confident. But committing a crime in the U.S. Capitol was a different experience altogether. She tried to radiate authority as she strode up the marble steps to the Capitol's North Senate entrance. It helped that she was dolled up like a successful K Street lobbyist. Two men coming out of the portico murmured hello to her, and one turned to watch her pass. His glance was appreciative, but not shocked. She was young and beautiful, but she looked like she belonged in this world of high-octane political deal-making. Good. She stepped out of the muggy August twilight and into the air-conditioned cool of the security vestibule. To calm herself, she concentrated on the feeling of lace garters skimming her thighs. This was one of the riskiest moments, so she arranged her face into its brightest smile. Hello. She greeted the two Capitol police officers with cool professionalism. I have an appointment with Congressman Lionel. Her heart beat like hummingbird wings as she handed her ID to the officer sitting behind the counter. But the guard just smiled as he cross-checked the ID against a paper in his clipboard. When she was on the other side of the metal detector, she took her purse off the X-ray belt and exhaled. She stood in the quiet entranceway, sensing the officers checking out her legs. The hallway was 1800s chic, mosaic floor, arch ceilings, black iron candelabras casting a golden glow on flesh-colored walls. She'd heard that the Capitol was one of the most haunted buildings in D.C., and she imagined the ghost of John Quincy Adams swirling through the corridor. Was it always so empty? This was a private back entrance reserved for congressmen, staffers, and VIP visitors. And it was almost 8 p.m. Most employees were home. Still, she wished it were busier. A gangly young man rounded the corner. He wore an ill-fitting suit and sneakers, which, along with a smudge of tinted clearasil at his temple, identified him unmistakably as an intern. Ms. McBride? Yes. Inwardly, she cringed at the sound of her real name, but she was an expert at keeping a serene face no matter what was in her head. Besides, the kid was harmless in the way that only a young man wearing his first suit can be. I'm Chester, Congressman Lionel's intern. I can take you up to his office. Thank you. She walked with him down the corridor. So what are you here to see the congressman about? Constituent services. She smoothly changed tacks. What do you do for the congressman? Men, whatever their age, were always happy to talk about themselves. The intern enthusiastically described the process for answering congressional correspondence. We can send 60 different form letters, depending on what a constituent asked about. The clack of her heels echoed off the walls as they walked into a circular chamber, large and ornate as a cathedral. She remembered coming here 10 years ago on a seventh-grade field trip. This was the rotunda, the ceremonial heart of the Capitol. She recognized the iconic canvases, the Declaration of Independence, the landing of Columbus. The domed ceiling 180 feet above was covered with a fresco painting of the first president depicted as a god among angels. Wow, she whispered. For the first time that night, Caroline had a real sense of the history of the place. So much had happened in this building. So many famous people had made world-changing decisions here. Who was she to be prancing through? She was a fraud. Then she noticed the paintings of revolutionary America. Among hundreds of soldiers, explorers, and men in white wigs, she saw only 4 women. Of those, 2 were naked and on their knees. She felt better. Some things never changed. She wasn't a fraud. She was a constant. Chester led her past a sign that said no visitors beyond this point. They went up a series of curved staircases, down some empty white corridors, and stopped in front of an unlabeled door tucked around a corner. Here's the congressman's hideaway. She had no idea what a hideaway was. His personal office, a little oasis where he can get away from the hustle-bustle. There didn't seem to be much hustle-bustle at this hour, but Caroline understood the precaution. Her prior appointments at the congressman's regular office in the less glamorous Rayburn office building had caused difficulties. She was glad for the privacy this place afforded. Chester pushed open the door and gestured for Caroline to go in. He himself stood outside as if fearful of crossing the threshold. The door clicked shut behind her. The hideaway was quiet and unoccupied. It looked more like a sitting room in a nice hotel than an office. A door at the back was open to a wide marble balcony overlooking the National Mall. Caroline's breath caught. The Washington Monument and Lincoln Memorial were framed against a fiery sunset. A man stood on the balcony, his elbows resting on the railing, his back to her. The sunset threw his figure into dark silhouette. She smoothed her skirt and ran a manicured hand through her hair. This was the part she liked best. She was good at it. Great, to be honest. She had a talent for it like nothing else she'd ever tried. It gave her incredible satisfaction. She smiled and walked out to meet him. A woman's scream pierced the stillness of the Capitol grounds. Officer Jeff Cook was on patrol on the Capitol steps. He put a hand on his holster and turned toward the sound. His eyes flicked over the scenery until they identified the source of the scream. There, up the hill, the third-floor balcony of the Capitol's south wing, a man and a woman locked in a jerky dance. Cook couldn't make out the people, but he knew the geography. That was Congressman Lionel's hideaway. The couple lurched left then right. The woman shrieked again. Then the man shoved her over the edge. The woman seemed to fall in slow motion, emitting an operatic wail the whole way down. Arms flailed in graceful circles, legs kicked in lazy swings as she dropped past marble flourishes and arched doorways. A thud and silence. She landed on the marble terrace in front of the Capitol. Elegant for walking on, it was a disastrous place to fall. What would that slab of rock do to flesh and bones traveling at the speed of gravity? Cook squinted back up at the balcony. The man was still up there. He peered over the balcony, then turned and disappeared inside. Cook ran towards the Capitol steps. Dun, dun, dun.
And there you have it. Now, and I'll give you some time to catch your breath. You know, and when you're writing an opening like that, because it's very dramatic and bam, you know, the murder's kind of right off, and the intrigue, of course, is right off of who pushed her over the balcony, the whole get-up of everything that's going on, the kind of, I mean, you have the elements of, you know, you have the back hideaway of a congressman and a senator, which people are going to be like, is that really true? Do they have those things? you know, the line, you know, the well-manicured hand to go through her hair and, you know, the lace garters and those types of, you know, little detail touches that you kind of put in to kind of have such a explosive opening. I just want to, I mean, I'm just sitting here and I was just like, you know, just keep going.
Oh, good.
You know,
well, that's exactly the reaction I'm hoping for. So
yeah,
I'm glad
just
that
keep
that's
reading.
Well, it's funny about the lace garters because I went back and forth on those lace garters over and over. Took them in, put them out, in, out, in, out. And finally, my husband was like, I really like the lace garters. Keep them in. So I dedicate those lace garters to my husband, Mike.
Way to go. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the lace garters of keeping them in. Because, you know, that's the kind of thing, and it's very difficult when, you know, I've been on many panels. I've heard many things from, you know, a lot of the top, women thriller writers, it's very difficult because when they see a woman's name on the book, men are generally going to assume, oh, this is romantic and it's not going to be any interesting and I don't want to deal with the romance part. But what they forget is that it's the romance part in the book, it's those underlying genres that make the whole thriller. And those little sentences and those details and things that you put in are not only, I mean, they're not really romantic, I mean, they're freaking erotic. And that's the stuff that you want to read. I mean, as a man, it's like, why would you shun that?
Good. Well, good. We need more cheerleaders like that. So
keep
it up, John.
Yeah. And so, and again, that was an excerpt. And that was what part of the book exactly was it? Was that starting really with page one? Was that right there?
That's page one. I took some sentences out to keep it short. But that's starting with page one. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, you asked about the hideaways. There really are these hideaways, and I was intrigued by them. For a long time, they were very secret. It's only in the last couple of decades that people have even heard about them or talked about them. And they're these tiny little interstitial spaces within the Capitol itself. Most of the congressmen and the senators, have their offices in the office buildings that surround the Capitol, but they have these little offices, and some of them are quite luxurious. Some of them are just these tiny little boiler rooms, and you get them depending on seniority. And they have historically been the enablers of some very famous womanizers, like LBJ was purported to have had a lot of affairs in his little hideaway. So I thought that was a fascinating place. And as a prosecutor, you look at the city one way, you see a lot of these kind of grim landmarks. As I drive around, I'm always thinking, oh, that, you know, I know in what happened in that parking lot. It's so sad. But as a crime novelist, you look at the city also from this different perspective where I'm constantly looking around and thinking, where would be a good place for a murder to occur? Where can I kill somebody in this city? And I thought the hideaway was just a great place for a murder to happen. It just seemed like the perfect setting, so I had to use it.
Well, you know, one of my favorite, and I just happened to think, one of my favorite movies, thriller movies, actually start Cher and Dennis Quaid and Liam Neeson, and it was called Suspect, and it was about Cher, who was a defense attorney in D.C., and you kind of see those little back behind the scenes kinds of things, because D.C. holds a lot of secrets that an author like yourself can exploit, and you're gonna, and it's almost gonna have the fans wondering, is it true, is it not true, just because there is so much secrecy that goes on in the politics and the government that you do have a lot of kind of leeway to explore those things.
Absolutely. The material is just so rich in Washington, D.C., and there's so many different facets of the city to explore. There's the, you know, the seat of power, the seat of government, and all of the men and women, a lot of powerful men who come in there, and a lot of times their world is crossing over with this extremely seamy underbelly of D.C., which is not, you know, it doesn't make it to the postcard, doesn't often make it to the news, but is there and exists and coexists with this other world. And I find where they intersect to be just a very fascinating place. And so that's what I really focused on in Discretion. And, boy, there's a lot of great material to work with.
And, again, we're talking with author Allison Liotta. She just read an excerpt from her book called Discretion. If you happen to join us a little late, you can always go back and listen to that. And the one thing that, like, when I was just in here mentioning, is that D.C. has all these wonderful stories. Do you find it difficult yourself as an author to make sure that the series is kind of about Anna and not really more about the plot, even though the plots are so much intriguing, you still have to, you know, you still have to make sure that Anna is, you know, all involved in the series and she grows and she grows. Do you have that balance? Have you been able to kind of, you know, understand and say, okay, I need to find that balance between the plots that are going on because they are very interesting, and then Anna as the character, so she evolves correctly.
That's a great point, and it is something that I have to be cognizant of. There are these fascinating cases, and there are all these kind of wonderful stories that you can bring to life in the books, but it really is about these characters, and people want to read the book because they like the characters. And
Allison, are you there?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
I got you. You kind of went a little quiet. I went out a little bit. So what were you saying again? What was the last part?
Well, you know, when you're a prosecutor, every case affects you on some level and changes you on some level. You meet these people you haven't met before. You hear about their lives. You hear what's going on, and you are changed because of it. You can never go back to being the person you were before you heard about this crime and how it affected the folks involved. And so that's an easy way to kind of connect it to the main character. But you also, as a writer of a series, you have to find a way that this character is going to grow and change and arc with each book. And that is a series. You find that you're very invested in this character. You love her. She's
right.
You know, she's my main companion most days. So it is interesting and fun to watch her grow and see she throw some hurdles her way.
Well, I want to tell you what, Allison, you've done another wonderful job coming out of the gate, hitting two home runs with Law of Attraction and now Discretion with your character, Anna Curtis. And we just want to thank you again so much for coming on and reading the excerpt of Discretion and talking about the book and your character and everything that, you know, you got going on. And a lot of people have to realize they can go to your blog because you like to, you know, you let people know what's real and what's wrong in, like, the Special Victim Unit shows that you have going on, and that's very interesting.
Thank you. Yes, I do run this blog. The blog has been really successful. I evaluate what Law & Order SCU is getting right and wrong from my perspective as a real sex crimes prosecutor, and it's been great. People really are drawn to it, so that's been fun, too, and much more constructive than just throwing a slipper at the TV, which is what I used to do.
And when they cancel SVU, because I don't know if it's kind of coming down to the end here, but is there another show on the horizon that you think that you might take on to write a blog about?
There are so many great shows. We'll have to brainstorm about that. I just started watching Breaking Bad, and, oh, man, it's such a good show. I'm going to have to download all that once I'm done with book number 3. But I don't know, maybe The Good Wife, maybe I'll take a poll and find out what people want to hear, because that's what I want to be doing. I want to be blogging about what folks are most interested in. So maybe the poll is the way to go. What do you think, John?
Yeah.
What's your favorite crime show?
I'll tell you what. I mean, there's a lot of shows. There's one that I saw that's coming out called The Mob Doctor, and I'm really scared about that because it's like, because when I look at a show, I'm trying to realize how can these shows have any staying power, and I don't know how shows like that can have staying power. But I'm kind of like the angel of death with shows, is that when I start watching them, they like to cancel it. Like Alcatraz, you know, they go ahead and they cancel, and some of these other ones, I'm like, so I'm scared to watch them. I almost like want to wait till they're on Netflix so I don't kill them. But yeah, there are some good ones. And, you know, a lot of people say Breaking Bad, and I think that's the meth guy. I don't really watch the show. I don't think I've ever seen an episode.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another one that's really funny that's out there. It's called Weeds. And that's a really funny one because it's kind of along the same premise where a mom is a drug dealer and she's selling marijuana and, you know, to keep herself up after her husband dies. And that's kind of, I don't think it's quite as intense as the Breaking Bad one, but it's a funny little show, and I always find that one funny.
Okay, well, I will consider that one. I will put that
one
on my poll when I decide if SVU gets canceled.
Because there are a lot of good shows, and it's just always, and it finds it always interesting that there are a lot of good shows. And, you know, hopefully we're able to find maybe Anna Curtis gets her own series someday. You just never know. You just never know how those things work out.
Well, yes, that would be lovely. That would be absolutely lovely. So if you want to set that up, John, that sounds great.
I know I'm in Hollywood, and I will do my best. You never know. Well, Allison, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Enjoy your day. Hopefully it's not too hot out there where you're at because, you know, it's hot here in L.A., so you've left at the right time from RWA. But we want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk to you. It's great to be on the show.
All right. We will see you when you're on the road again, wherever you're at. You know, you can always contact us, and we will make sure that we stay in touch. And, you know, we just want to make sure that we have everything that's going on. Let us know so we can let people know what's happening.
I will. Thank you so much, John and Shannon.
All right. Bye-bye, Allison. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. You too.
So, again, everybody, author Allison Leota, and the book is called Discretion, her second book in the Anna Curtis series. AllisonLeota.com is her website to go to find out information. Again, if you happen to listen a little late, you can rewind and check out the beginning that she just read live on the air of Discretion. And like I said, when she finishes, you're going to want to go no and start shaking your monitor because you want to keep the book going. And that's the perfect time to go and click and download and read right away. So we want to thank all of our guests for coming on to the show today. It's been an outstanding show. We had Karen Slaughter on first to talk about her book, Criminal. And you can find out her stuff at KarenSlaughter.com. Jeffrey Wilson was on, and he talked about his book, The Donors. And, again, we just had Allison Leota on. We are going to be back next week with another great show. D.P. Lyle, Jaden Terrell, and Michael Chris are going to be on. We were going to have Greg Hurwitz. So if you saw the website, he had to bow out. He had another thing. We're going to try to fill that slot. Otherwise, the show will start at 10:30 instead of 10 next weekend. So, okay, everybody, enjoy yourself. Get out there and read because it's too damn hot across the country to do anything else. So stay safe. We will see you guys all next week. Again, I'm John Robb, your host. This is Suspense Radio. Have a good day.